21 years old. I'll admit that the Roan 55, the 21-year-old tower, looks pretty good. I'll admit that the Roan number 6 tower, which is 40-some-odd years old, doesn't look so good. But it's doing the job. A tower doesn't suddenly crumble. It doesn't suddenly turn into a noise generator. It doesn't suddenly turn into a descent. And by the way, the galvanizing that comes off the tower after its number of years of service life does not come off in the joints. You take apart the joints, they look beautiful. They weren't exposed to the weather. It's on the outside of the tower, away from the joints, that your eye looks at it, where it starts seeing a little bit of the galvanizing disappear and a little bit of the rust build up. But the tower itself has got, let me drop, I forget the exact number, but it's probably 20, 30, 40,000ths of an inch of steel. For you to rust through all of that to give you structural weakness where the tower starts becoming a danger, there's all kinds of ways you can test that. The failure of a tower, the majority of what you're talking about with the galvanizing is eye beauty. Yeah, the galvanizing can completely disappear, the tower can look rusty as all hell, and it can still be structurally very sound. I'll admit you've got to do a little bit more fancy investigating to confirm its structural integrity, but to thoroughly rust through a Roan tower, those numbers you're hearing, and you think you've got to replace the tower, I strongly disagree with that. Back to you, Dennis, for any comment on that. K2LAW.
Obviously, that's going to be a big thank you, and I'm going to bring that information and the fact that it even appeared in the Roan catalog, not just your say-so, which I know is good anyhow. We'll bring that up in the next couple of days, too, over our repeater. We got in a lot of nervous nellies already just by those comments that, oh, my God, how many ham fests are we going to have to run just to get the kind of funds that we need to replace the tower? He quoted us a number, and the guy that actually talked to him felt that there was a matter of, no, this guy doesn't sound like he's trying to sell us a tower either. He sounds like he's sincere and knows what he's talking about, but I questioned it myself. Maybe the economy is a little tough down there in Texas or wherever the darn things are built too. So, guys, let me say again a big, wonderful thank you for all the information. I'll probably join you next week and pick up the trail again, and we'll see what's gone on in this week. But as far as even that thought, that that tower doesn't need to be replaced, is a big improvement on a bad situation. So even if we don't make some tests otherwise, I don't know what else I can add, but have a great week, great evening, and I appreciate this stuff that it did go out on the transcript so that somebody can also hear that. If they don't want to believe me, they can listen to it on the amateurradio.tv. 7-3, guys, it's all been very helpful. W2IU.
Comment.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
We got at least two comments, and one other thing. Even if the tower was thoroughly rusted and ugly looking, which I doubt very highly after such a small number of years, my guess is it still looks beautiful. The next step would be to get one of your enthusiastic guys or to hire a service that simply painted the tower with zinc-rich paint. And there's also very fancy epoxy paints that are so-called rust-dissolving or rust-inhibiting paints. There's all kinds of ways you can keep using the exact same tower. To replace that tower after 11 years, that is absolutely crazy. The first person who said comment, and after that we're going to go to Russ. The first person who said comment, go right ahead. Give me your full call letters and name, K2LAW in the tech net. My name is Zick.
Russell has a comment.
I've got to come back, Dick. I was the first comment there. KO2OK Bennett. I'll be right back.
Okay, Glenn was the second commenter. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Just a quick note. The other comment that was made initially about the item that was being talked about the tower wasn't just rusting away. I think the other comment was that he was saying was that he wanted to isolate the antenna at the top of the tower galvanically and breaking it with some kind of piece of plastic. I don't think that's a very good idea, especially because of lightning protection and other things like that. But I'll pass that one back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of reasons why you don't want to isolate the antenna. And if you think that's the reason you're getting, desensitization by third-order intermodulation, passive intermodulation distortion, the chances of that being a reality are very, very slim. I doubt it highly. So there's a lot more to this story, and a lot of misinformation is taking place. The next person who gave us a comment was, I guess, Elmer, W2LSR. Go right ahead, Elmer.
I think you meant me, Dick, W2OSR. Let me see if I've got it.
Yeah, sorry about that, Bob. It sounded like LSR. OSR, you got it.
Okay, that's what happens when I speak too fast. Anyway, I've got a tower that's now, what is it, a little over 30 years old that I got used. And one of the things I did before I put it up was I coated it with a coating from Sherwin-Williams called Cold Galvanized. Now, it's been up about 3 years, and I don't see any degradation to that coating at this point, so it's a way to go. I'm sure they probably sell it in something other than spray cans, which is what I use. It's probably available in some sort of a brush-on application as well.
Yeah, the material in question goes by at least two names, zinc-rich paint or cold galvanizing. And in spray cans, I think is the easiest way to use it. And the spray cans have a date on them because there's Xylink or something like that. There's a fancy vehicle in there, a fancy solvent in there, which evaporates extremely fast. I know because I thought I was going to be real smart to buy a 1 gallon or a 5 gallon can of cold galvanizing zinc-rich paint. And I didn't get around to using it for a year. And even though the normal paint can cover was on there very tightly, I hadn't yet opened it. A year later, I opened it, and inside all the Xylinx, this very highly volatile material, had evaporated, and I had a solid mass of material that I could no longer use. So when you do buy cold galvanizing or zinc-rich paint, even a spray can, buy it within a few months of when you intend to use it, and shake the lemon daylights out of it so that all the jazz in the bottom gets thoroughly stirred up so that you get the real painting that you want. When you use a spray can of cold galvanizing or zinc-rich paint, depending on whether you buy it from Rust-Oleum or other brands, it goes by various names, as you can tell. And I sprayed it onto my turnbuckles and whatever on the top, on the bottom of the tower. And I sprayed that on, I guess, about 25 years ago. And it looks pristine. It does a beautiful job. So simply repaint your tower. Yeah, it's going to be 5% of the cost of replacing it, and a hell of a lot less effort. So I wouldn't even think about replacing a tower without going 25 or 30 years. That's me. You talk to Barry in Two Moon Bounce. Let me drop it.
Chromate.
Okay. The zinc chromate is that yellowish stuff. Not quite as good. It's good, but not quite as good as the so-called silvery-looking stuff, the cold galvanizing or zinc-rich paint. Zinc chromate is a very good primer, and it's good, but not quite as good as these other things. And there's also a rust-converting kind of paint that you can use. It's even better yet, but a little bit more expensive. But Barry N2MB is using a windjammer-type tower. I keep forgetting the brand name of the thing. Formo Motor or something like that. His particular tower, I think, is close to 50 years old, exposed to continuous salt spray in Far Rockaway. And so you'd be amazed how long you can use a tower after the galvanizing has disappeared, as long as you do proper inspection and maintenance. I'm not saying walk away from a tower for 40 years and don't do anything to it. I'm not saying that. Do inspection periodically, but if you think it's got to be perfectly shiny and beautiful as the day you put it up, otherwise it's going to suddenly fall down and it's going to suddenly stop functioning, I highly doubt that. Already, let's see. Rich N2EO, I know you had a question.
CPZ also has a comment.
And Wesley has a question.
K2TV with a comment.
Okay. Let's see. Hal first. Go ahead, Hal.
Okay, very good, Jack, and I love that you checked that. I just want to say, I have an EZ-Way tower. It's been up over 25 years, and what I did, I used Rust-Oleum, and it did a very good job on taking care of the tower where it hasn't rusted. I have it kind of the tower used. Before I put it up, I used Rust-Oleum, painted it, and the Rust-Oleum's still on it, and I have no rust breakdown. And the other comment was I was going to make, one second. If you go and buy any balums or anything at Hamfest, be it a 4-to-1 or a 1-to-1 balum, very easy way of checking a balum is on a 1-to-1 balum, take a little 50 1-ohm carbon resistor, 1/4 watt,
stick it on one side, use a MFJ antenna analyzer on the other. If you got a match, the Balum is good. If it's a 4-to-1 Balum, take a 200 ohm carbon resistor, stick it on one side, put your MFJ analyzer on the other, and if it matches, the Balum is good. That's my comments for this evening, Dick. Go ahead and pick it up.
Hi, Hal. The most popular way of pronouncing the machine is Balum, B-A-L-U-M. Baker Alpha Lima Uniform November. A lot of people put a mic and a Bravo in there, but the most popular way of pronouncing it, it stands for balanced to unbalanced. It's a contraction of two words. That's the most popular way it's usually pronounced. How good information, though. Thank you. Bob, K2 Tango Victor, go right ahead with your comment.
Yes, good evening, Dick. On the comment on the, wanted to make a comment on the tower. On my tower, I had a little patina of rust, and I inspected regularly, and I wanted to paint it. Did a little bit of research. I found a rust converter called One Step. It's called the Rust Killer. I bought it from a company down in Sarasota, Florida. It's runs about, I believe, $50 a gallon. You don't need very much. Stuff looks like skim milk when you put it on a tower. And what it basically does is turn the rust to black color. And where there's galvanizing, it kind of encapsulates the galvanizing. You use two coats on there, and when I finished with that, I waited a few days and then coated it with gray Rust-Oleum Professional, and I used two coats of that, and the thing turned out real nice. But you really have to inspect it well, and what you have to really be careful of is rusting from the inside of the towers. Make sure all the legs are good, and that there's, you know, if it's got serious rust on it, then that's another story. But if it has just a light patina of rust, this rust converter, or they call it the rust killer, is really good. It really worked good. It did the job for me. And it's if you look up on the internet, interstateproducts.com, one word, interstateproducts.com, it's there. It's pretty good stuff, and I'm not sure there's any number of companies that make it, but it did a real nice job. Back to you, Dick, K2TV.
Very fine, Bob. Nice information. So One Step Rust Killer from interstateproducts.com. Good to know. Bennett, KO2OK, I think it is. I think you had a comment. Go right ahead. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Dick, just DPZ, if I could get in with a real fast comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
Now, I'm from California. We talk a little different than the New Yorkers. You'll have to excuse me for my pronunciation.
Perfectly all right. But I'm just telling you what is the most popular pronunciation and the origin of the word balanced to unbalanced. So in those two words that are being contracted, there is no M. And I know that quite a few Californians do it that way. Mel does also. And Mel's not from California, but he talks to a lot of Californians. Bennett, KO2OK, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick, good evening, and hi, Hal. This is KO2OK. The name is Bennett. And, boy, but in the meantime that I had the phone call, I think my comments were covered. So one was, be careful of towers rusting from the inside out. The outside can look pretty good. And meanwhile, you require some good inspection. There's been a couple of stories out there with people with house-attached towers, and then at the base, when they took the house brackets off and were ready to, to remove sections from it, it crumbled at the bottom. It was all rusted through from the inside. It looked good from the outside. And the water gets in from either not all the screw holes being used up, or even if they were, I guess water seeping in as the rain comes down the tower and inside. That's one comment. And the other one was how to quickly check the balance. So you've got all those covered. So I don't have anything else. I've had my Rhone 25 up for about 12 years, and before that was up for another person's house for about another 12 or 13 years. And light coats of rust, just like a kitchen scrub pad and scrub it down, and again, light coat of Rust-Oleum, even thinned out. It works great and stays up for a long time. Back to net. Thanks, Dick. KO2, okay.
Yeah, very good information there, Bennett. I have seen a couple of YouTube videos of where an extremely foolish person decided to take down a tower, and it was being recorded by somebody with a camcorder. And the foolish person was up at the 50-foot level. He takes off the 50-foot tower section. He then comes down to the 40-foot level where there's some guy wires. And while he's on the tower, he disconnects the guy wires at the 40-foot level. The foolish guy said, hey, the bottom of the tower is into that concrete pad at the base, and the concrete was below grade so that water could gather at the base of the tower and spill down to the concrete and sit there as a pool of water at the base of the tower. If you think that 40 feet of tower is going to be held up securely by way of a chunk of concrete, I don't care how much, what the integrity of the tower is, how many feet into the ground the concrete is. If you calculate the forces at that base, it will scare the daylights out of you. The guy should have put on a temporary set of guy wires. He's at the 40-foot level, disconnects the guy wire, and 40 feet of tower with him on it falls over. Very foolish mistake. You got to plan these things out. Towers with guy wires, the guy wires give you 99% of the strength. One of my towers, one of my 100-foot-high towers, is held up with four sets of guy wires. And the base of the tower has got that metal flat plate that's supposed to go onto a piece of concrete. It's sitting on top of my lawn for 42 years, 41 years. Doesn't go anywhere. There's a couple of spikes through it to make sure it doesn't slide out to one side. But there is no real concrete at all. And I expected the base of the tower to be sinking into the ground and compressing the dirt, and I'd have to be tightening up the guy wires. I check the guy wires every couple of years, and I've never had to tighten them. I replaced the guy wires because they were rusting over the 40-year...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Over the 40-year period of time. So guy wires really give you all the strength of the tower. And do not depend on the concrete base to do anything. In the case of a self-standing tower, they make the base of the tower super strong so that the concrete can do something. But even then, I wouldn't trust it. My belt and suspenders philosophy of life is that if I had a crank-up tower, I would still put guy wires on at least the first section, if not more of them. But that's me. I got a lot of faith in guy wires, as you can tell. Okay, I think I've answered all of the questions.
And to examine with the questions.
Yeah, go ahead, Wesley.
Okay,
Wesley and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, Dick, last segment we were talking about A2 and A3 and SSB, and just direct disagreement of your statement of single sideband when you stated that from the receiver part there is a whole benefit of utilizing single sideband. And that fact, I mentioned that the width of the single sideband comparing to AM is one-third, let me jump.
Wesley, you're entering into another subject, but we're going to go to that exact subject when we go back to the technical stuff after we go to the mailbag. Based on what's happening with the Voyager spacecraft, which is now 10 billion miles away, it is three times the distance of Pluto, and NASA is still continuing to communicate with that spacecraft. So what you're into right now, we're going to be covering that in a little bit. Let me go over to Eric's question or comment. Go ahead, Eric, K2EJ, K2RAW, TechNet.
K2RAW, K2EJ, Portable 4, Donald Flatter here. I just wanted to mention that my 300-foot tower comes to a point on the bottom. It actually sits on a ball, and it is the guy wires that maintain the integrity of the tower. And, of course, we inspect them every year, and occasionally they have to get replaced. Those guy lines are torqued at about 4,700 foot-pounds, which is a pretty reasonable amount of tension, and, of course, to make the tower plumb because the thing sits on a ball by the tension of the guy wires. also wanted to mention that we use a paint which is made by Pittsburgh Paint. It's called Tower A, and it comes in different colors, white, aviation white, aviation orange. And the stuff is good for, as far as the FAA is concerned, because they're interested in the reflectivity of the paint, not necessarily the less preserving properties of the paint. But it typically lasts anywhere from 5 to 10 years. But that's basically what I wanted to say. KQ item, UK to the Yankees.
KB1IFY, what a comment on the towers. Okay, IFY recognized. KB1IFY, get to you in a second. Eric, that ball at the bottom of your tower is now a very popular technique. It's called a zero-moment base. One of the things that I've often done on my 100-foot of row number 6 tower is stand up at the 90-foot level, where at the 100-foot level, where I'm 10 feet above a guy wire. It's guide at 30, 50, 70, 90. So I'm 10 feet above a guy wire, standing on the top of this fairly flimsy tower. Row number 6 is older Roan stuff, not super strong. And if I push myself away and toward the tower, I'm flexing it. I'm using the mass of my body to create a cyclic oscillation. And when I look down the tower, I see the tower snaking back and forth, zigzagging, so to speak, in between each one of those guy stations. That's what the wind does with every tower you've ever seen. When the wind blows in certain ways, it is flexing your tower. If the bottom of the tower is into a chunk of concrete, you think you're more secure. The tower is being bent at that area, and it's creating a fatigue failure. By making a ball at the bottom of the tower, where it can flex, now it can skew itself any way it wants to in between the guy wires, and none of the metal is being given an excess amount of strain, and therefore we're creating a fatigue failure. So a so-called zero-moment base, the ball at the bottom of the tower, is a very popular technique on tall broadcast commercial towers, and we amateurs are slowly coming around to that. You go to the right catalog, let me drop. You go to the right Roan catalog, and they recommend that you take your concrete base, do not sink the tower into the concrete. You're putting the concrete pier there just to go below the frost line to have something that doesn't move. You're supposed to put a slight convex shape to the top of the concrete pier. In other words, it bubbles out very slightly. And then the metal base at the flat plate at the bottom of your tower sits on top of that slightly concave surface with a pier pin in the center to make sure the tower can't shift itself off to one side. The pier pin is into the concrete. Now the tower can flex back and forth as if it had a ball at the bottom, and it's really rocking that metal plate. That's the way my Roan 55 is mounted ever since 1969. That was the technique of the Roan catalog recommended then. They keep changing, and they keep becoming more and more conservative, and now deciding to say things that are, I can tell it's written by the attorneys, it's not written by the real tower engineers, if you know what I mean. They make it sound like if each one of the guy wires going down to the ground is not exactly the same altitude above sea level. If one of the guy wires is mounted to a chunk of ground that's a little bit higher, they call it an unbalanced tower, and if the tower falls down, they'll say, you didn't use our rule, and therefore that's why it fell. It's got absolutely nothing to do with it. You take a look at the tower that's out at Channel 55, where it's built alongside of a sand pit, and this 550-foot-high tower, one set of guy wires is mounted to a chunk of earth that's 150 feet lower than other guy wires in other directions. A perfectly good installation. So saying that each of the guy wires have to go down the exact same altitude of ground is crazy. As I said, they're doing that because the attorneys told them to do that for extra safety. Okay, KB1IFY, start off with your name, sir. My name is Dick, and your comment or question. We can't change subjects right yet. Go right ahead, IFY. Take a
repeater. Time out. Repeater.
You've got it, IFY.
I was waiting for the beep. Yeah, KB1IFY. Good evening, Dick. Good evening, all the one. The net over here. You got Bill in Stanford. A while back, Dateline had a special on power safety. Don't know if it was this past July that did it or the July before. I know it was on 7/21 about tower safety, and just wanted to make, I don't know if you guys remember that segment or not, but I figured it all falls in place to what you guys are talking about.
Give us a thumbnail sketch, Bill. Was that the one where a guy was removing guy wires and assuming the concrete base that was put in 30 years ago was going to hold up his rusted tower, and he fell over with it? What was the... the Dateline stand, Dateline presentation. What basically did it show, Bill? Go ahead.
Oh, a dog.
Yeah, well, actually, I still have it on my DVR box over here. Let me find it over here. I'll tell you on the next key up. All I'm saying is, what did it show? Did it show a proper or an improper tower installation?
It had these guys, they call themselves tower dogs.
Okay, Mel, you seem to remember it. Go right ahead, Mel, and I think you also wanted to make a comment. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, we're running late. Okay, so let's just say the final words on towers. They did that program on called the guys that climbed towers, mostly high cell towers, and do the work on it and how dangerous their job is. And they call themselves tower dogs, D-O-G-S. Well, of course, they spend the night before in the bar. That makes things easier, supposedly. All kidding aside, what those guys do, some of them are really amazing. All right, now let me say final words on it. As far as mounting the tower here in the backyard, it had to have a cage built. This rebar cage that I had sunk into the ground here had to be constructed and welded together because the building department here would not give me a certification on the tower, and so I could get insurance and permits and all, unless I did exactly the way they told me with the cage and the concrete deal. And then the tower was coated with that chromate, and then a finish called a chrome finish. So if you look at my tower, let me let it drop down. Today, if you stood out there and tried to look at my tower, you would have to put on sunglasses. That's how shiny it is. And I just also changed the guy wires in June because my tower is subjected 350 feet off the Atlantic Ocean. It's, you know, the worst. All right. What do you say? We better get to the bag because it's getting too late, others pretty soon, Dick, over.
Yes, we got one more guy that signed in, John, WA2Z, Victor Delta Hotel. I hope John can hang in there. Let's go to the mailbag, which we should have done starting at 8 o'clock, correction, 9 o'clock, and then we'll go back to the more heavy subject. Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, well, I'm looking through. I'm looking for, like I say, always looking for the young people. All right, here's a group. We started a ham club at our junior high school, and now we also are beginning to study astronomy. Now, we've gotten a lot of good advice from you on our amateur radio activity. As far as astronomy goes, could you suggest any way we could put together a telescope or, you know, homebrew a telescope as a project? Where can we get the information, and what would you suggest? Very good question for a change, Dick. Go ahead.
Wow. That is interesting and a little bit different than normal, but a good science project. I would start off by going to Sky and Telescope magazine, and they've got a beautiful website. You go to skyandtelescope.com, I think is their website. Sky and Telescope magazine has been around for 50, 80 years, some ridiculous length of time. And they have a series of articles on their website. What should your first telescope be? I mean, the average person thinks that you walk into a store that sells telescopes and you buy the highest possible gain number. In other words, here's one telescope that claims it has 200 power and one that claims 300 power. Well, of course, the one that claims 300 power sounds better. Absolutely wrong. You depending on what aperture size you've got in the front, there's an ideal number. I think the answer is 60 to 1. In other words, the number of inches on the front of the telescope, for each inch, you can't go beyond 60. You can try to if you want, but you're just going to get a blurry picture. There's also a whole set of articles on how to grind your own mirror. The so-called Ritchie article, I think it was. But on that website, they will show you where you can find the series of books of how to grind your own mirror. However, there's a catch. Let me drop. When you desire a telescope, you guys are going to have to sit down and do a soul search. What is your desired end product? If your desired end product is to look through a high-performance telescope, look at the stars, and maybe do astrophotography, but you've got a limited budget, then you're going to buy the components. You're going to buy the mirror already ground, the parabolic mirror. By the way, anything beyond about 3 inches, you're not going to use a lens. You're going to use a mirror, in my opinion. You get a lot more for your money. And the mirrors can be anything from 3.5 up to 16 inches in diameter. You can buy them. You buy a mirror from a good house that's building mirrors, and it will save you a year of your life. You could decide, if you want to buy the raw piece of glass, buy the grinding material, mount the blank on the barrel, and use the grinding material in between, and rock your arms back and forth on the main mirror, and keep walking around the barrel. And a year later, if you do all the steps right, you've got a mirror. But it takes you a year to do it, and the chances of doing it successfully the first time are very slim. With 1 or 2 weeks' salary, you can buy the mirror, or you can spend a year of your life grinding one. I'm not saying which you should do. Let me drop. If you enjoy the science of the way a parabolic or a near-parabolic surface forms automatically when you walk around this barrel and rock this mirror back and forth on the blank with the grinding material in between, if you enjoy the science of what happens and the science of doing the Foucault test, as it's pronounced, and you parabolize the actual mirror, you start off with a near spherical surface, and you eventually do a correction, you get it to the nearest millionth of an inch, and you make it into a smooth parabola. The process by which you do that is a very interesting chunk of science, and you might enjoy that. So is it the process of building that you'll get enjoyment out of, or the process of using? You have to make that decision. It is my belief that 90% of the people who are interested in astronomy should buy the mirror, not grind it. And if you go to the right parts house and you buy the mirror, you buy the optical tube, you buy the 45-degree mirror, you buy the focusing adjustment, you build the eyepieces, and then you put it all together. And the best is, most is for the least, it seems to be the so-called Dobson drive. Mr. Dobson came up with a technique where the mass center of the bottom of the telescope is what's really mounted to the ground, and everything pivots from that. It's a very crafty way of building a telescope. So, as I said, an awful lot of the material from all of those indicated websites that are on Sky and Telescope website and Sky and Telescope magazine, that's going to give you a tremendous amount of information in a hurry. Also, Edmund Scientific sells you a series of books that tell you how to build and buy. The good news about Edmund Scientific, let me drop. The Edmund Scientific Company I can't think of the name of the town in New Jersey where they're located, they sell a lot of optical stuff. That's the good news. And they sell a lot of good books. That's the good news. The bad news is their prices are a little bit high, but they've got quality stuff. So the combination of Edmund Scientific and Sky and Telescope magazine and everything that leads you into, you'll find a tremendous amount of information. Other kinds of web searches, just using the word telescope construction, telescope building. I think there is a particular page in every single issue of Sky and Telescope magazine called the Amateur Constructor or something like that. The Amateur Telescope Builder. Give you a lot of information. Go to a good library and read the past issues of Sky and Telescope magazine, the Amateur Constructor section, which is near the back of the magazine. Tremendous amount of information there. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Comment?
Who is the person with the comment?
KC2WGB.
Go right ahead, John.
Dick, you're assuming optical. Maybe they don't mean an optical telescope. I didn't hear that word.
Yeah, he might be talking about a radio telescope. Whoa. Go right ahead, Mel.
Oh, no. I'm talking about an optical telescope. They're not planning on getting into radio astronomy. That's not at least at this point. This is an astronomy club that's formed also alongside their amateur radio club. Edmund Scientific, yes, they were. I know I forgot all about them. They were in Barrington, New Jersey. I remember I've gotten a number of little gadgets and things for the kids years ago. We used to always mess around with some little robots and gadgets that they used to sell. Was there not, two questions that have come to mind, was there not a optical corporation, something in Lynbrook at one time that I visited, Dick?
Jaegers. Yeah, somebody just told me it was Jaegers, but there's been various optical companies that have come and gone, and places that sell good telescopes. There's one in Sayville, Long Island right now. I can't think of the name of it. Again, if you do the right kind of a web search, for telescope materials. There's a lot of them. There's quite a learning curve to find out what size telescope do you think you can afford and you desire. And as I said, there's a beautiful set of articles on the website for Sky and Telescope magazine answering the question, what should be your first telescope? You'd be amazed how many people who are falling into the trap saying that, well, I've got pretty deep pockets. I can sign a check. I'll go out and buy a 12-inch diameter telescope, and I'll start using it. Well, if you haven't worked your way up to that, when you find out how heavy and how difficult it is to transport, to take apart the individual components, transport it to where you're going to use it, and put it all back together, that $3,000 12-inch diameter telescope, although it's got a lot of capability, if you haven't worked your way up to it, it may end up gathering an awful lot of dust in the closet and get used twice, three times in the beginning, and then it sits there for the next 10 years not being used. You can easily fall into that trap. So do read those articles about what should your first telescope be. In some cases, just getting a medium good quality set of binoculars with a method of holding them steady so that they don't wave all over the place, and you do some good astronomy with binoculars, you'd be amazing what introduction that'll give you to what's going on in your particular sky. And you're going to have to find a place away from industrial environments in order to get the sky that's dark enough. The people in New York City have never really seen the stars. You go to Cherry Valley in Pennsylvania, which is a designated dark spot, and you'll see a Milky Way that you never knew was there because the sky is that dark. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WGB with another comment.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, first, Mel needs to know if they intend to do any type of photography, they're going to need an equatorial mount or a wedge. As Opsonian's not going to be able to do it for them. You'll need a little more information, but they can have a lot of fun, as I've had.
It turns out that there are a number of very crafty guys who found out how to put the equivalent of an equatorial mount on a Dobson. I didn't say it's easy, but you can make the Dobson take out the Earth's rotation, if you know what I mean, with some difficulty. I'll go over to you, Mel. K2RIW, K2KEY, the data.
Well, which I could say, this is a young group and all, and they're not most likely in a high budget situation to spend a lot of money, and maybe I don't know if the school in any way is going to subsidize them. So they are looking for, that's why, maybe homebrewing something, at least that they can get an insight into, like you say, what it's all about. Now, you say binoculars, that takes in quite a wide range. These binoculars, I see them advertised sometimes in the back of a magazine, you know, $29.95 or something. Are they adequate to really see much of the universe, Dick, over?
I wish there was a nice, simple answer to that one, Mel. One of those Russian-made set of binoculars that I bought, which I think is 20 power, 50 millimeter, ordinarily, a good set of those would be $1,500, and I think they were being sold for $75, some crazy price like that. They're not perfect, but I got an awful lot for the money. And you properly mount them on a tripod, and boy, I see some very good optical stuff through them. So there are some inexpensive priced binoculars that are extremely good. There's an awful lot of them out there that are terrible. And I don't know a really good way of separating one from the other, other than looking for the right kind of a product review. You're about to ask me, where do you look to find a product review to find out what is the quality of what you're buying? Again, there's got to be some websites that give you that. I don't remember seeing very many binocular product reviews in Sky and Telescope or Astronomy Magazine. Occasionally they're there, not too often. So, by the way, the main thing you care about with binoculars is how well collimated they are. In other words, the left eye and the right eye look at the same point at the same instant of time. I have, and so has Dave, N2APG. The two of us just love binoculars. And whenever we find a deal, let me drop here, too. Whenever Dave and I find an inexpensive set of, there is Dave, inexpensive set of binoculars at a flea market, we suck them up immediately. And the fact that they've been dropped down a flight of stairs and that they're a little bit bent and they're not collimated, that's a beautiful pair that we can buy for $5 and $10 that are worth, you know, 10 times or 100 times that price. To a guy who's crafty, to take a non-collimated set of binoculars and recollimate them, it's a real pleasurable thing to do. There is an extremely inexpensive book, $15 or $20 book, printed by the University of Michigan. I can't think of the name of the book, which tells you everything you want to know about binoculars.
It's like Seyfried. Seyfried.
Okay. Hey, Dave, let me pass it over to you. I bet you you've done some collimated. You know about this book printed by University of Michigan on binoculars. Give us a few words on all of the above. N28PG, our binocular expert, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Dave.
You're too kind. N28PG, binocular aficionado. Just getting back to the telescopes, that's a tough decision. And one thing that I would suggest for these young people is to get in touch with a couple of the local astronomy clubs. Most of them have observing sessions, especially, you know, in the fall and into the winter when skies are clear. And I'm sure they'd be more than happy to have the young people come down, you know, and look through many, many telescopes that people have set up. And they get an idea of, you know, what's what and things like that. Back to you, Dick.
Another excellent suggestion, Dave. On Long Island, by far the most active group I know of is ASLI, A-S-L-I, Astronomical Society of Long Island. This particular group is so enthusiastic. Every single Wednesday night, they hold a meeting. And on the particular Wednesday night of the month where the moon is new and the sky is dark, they hold an outdoor meeting, and they all bring their telescopes and binoculars and whatever and trade their stories. There are astronomy clubs, two or three of them on Long Island, one or two of them in Manhattan, a couple of them in the Bronx, two or three, maybe four or five of them in New Jersey. With the right kind of a search, you will find an astronomy club. And you'll have, within that astronomy club, you've got guys with 10, 15, 20 years experience building, grinding, putting charge-coupled device cameras on them, doing astrophotography. You'll find guys, everything from very simple to very complicated within the same club. And you show up there as a newbie. You say, I'm interested in astronomy, as long as you're not a really objectionable, obnoxious person. They'll welcome you with open arms. You don't have to join right away. They'll give you any piece of information you want. So just like this TechNet tries to help ham radio operators, there are astronomy clubs that do the best they can to try to create more amateur astronomers. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay. One final part of the question here. Let me see. Did you ever hear of a company called, I guess he meant, I think he spelled it wrong. I believe it's Questar, and they spelled it with two E's, Questar, but I believe it is Questar, if I'm not mistaken, Dick. I believe it's Q-U-E-S-T-A-R, Questar Corporation, and not Questar. Maybe I'm wrong, but he mentioned that somebody offered them the use of one of them. Do you feel this is a very complicated instrument and would be unable for us group new at this interest in astronomy to operate this piece of equipment? I believe he means the Questar system. Are you in any way familiar with it, Dick? Over.
Come in. Oh, boy. Me and Bo John know about Questar. An excellent company. That is a Cadillac. For years, probably for 30 solid years, page number 2 of every single issue of Sky and Telescope magazine had an advertisement by Questar. They made this 3.5-inch Maksutov telescope, which is a kind of a cassegrain telescope that you can easily put on the picnic table. And it had a nice clock drive in the bottom of it. And for a small telescope, 3.5-inch diameter, it gave you state-of-the-art performance. And is it too complicated to use? Absolutely not. Everything you're going to use has got a learning curve. You read the manual, you can't go wrong. I mean, if you misuse it because you think it's too complicated, it's not going to explode on you. Just don't aim it into the front and look into the eyepiece. That's about the only thing you can do that's truly damaging. Or don't take a piece of dry cloth that's got sand ground into it and think you're going to clean the lens. Don't do that either. I mean, other than those two really dumb things to do, it can't be too complicated. It's a lot of fun. And by the way, using a telescope with the right kind of a upside-down, right-side-up correcting device so that you don't get an inverted picture, and doing terrestrial observation with it, not only the sky, just looking at a bird at a far distance in a tree,
or looking at buildings a long distance away and looking at the way the air gets disturbed in between. Real fun type stuff from my point of view. You don't only use a telescope at nighttime. Properly used, as long as you don't violate anybody's privacy rules, you can have an awful lot of fun with them in the daytime too. So don't turn down a Questar. If the guy's only going to let you use it for an hour, take him up on it. John, what do you think about Questar? KC2 WGB, K2RIW. And how long have you been in astronomy, John?
About 40 years, Dick. Questar, excellent product. Everything you said, plus 10. In fact, Johnny Carson owned one. I had one for a while. The only drawback to it, if you need a Barlow lens or any attachments for it, that is rather hard to find at reasonable prices. Dick, I think you should, for the young people, you should explain the importance of binoculars with the color coding and the chromatic aberrations. Very important for astro viewing.
Yeah, what John's into right now is that the coating you put on lenses, the lenses on binoculars or the lenses on a refractor-type telescope, that's the one that's got pieces of glass up front. Ordinarily, something like 10% of the light reflects off the lens, just like what happens when you look at the storefront window of a store and you look at it at a grazing angle. You see the reflection of the light off the glass. And if you put the right kind of a coating on the glass, you can make the transmissivity of light go extremely higher. And don't fall into the trap of the red coating. I mean, a lot of people think that this reddish coating on binocular lenses is real high quality. It's not. That's low quality coating. The high quality coating, you can just barely tell that it's there and it's got a slight bluish tint to it. That's not a showstopper. If you buy a set of binoculars with the wrong coating on them, they'll be a little bit lower in efficiency. You'll give it a little bit of color shift. I'm wondering what you're most concerned about, John, by buying cheap binoculars with the wrong color coding and you're doing sky observing. At night, almost every star looks white to you. You take a time-lapse photograph of the sky with good color film or with a good charge-coupled device thing connected to your telescope, and you'll see that the stars are every single color of the rainbow. The stars really have that color. Can we drop? But the human eye at night makes all cats look gray, makes all stars look white. Very few human eyes, when looking at stars, will see any color but white. Those colors are really there, but because the light is so dim and it's so sharp in angular resolution requirement, that the photopic versus, what is it now called? Scotopic versus photopic vision. A fully dark adapted eye requires 20 minutes in the dark before your eye develops full sensitivity. And when you do what's called averted vision, in other words, you don't look directly at the star, you look a little bit off to one side, you're forcing your eye to use the rods, not the cones. The cones give you the color perception, but they're low in sensitivity, but they're in the fovea, the center of the eye. A little bit off to one side is where the rods dominate, and they are very high in sensitivity, but they only see black and white. So you'd use averted vision, and an awful lot of stars that you think are not there, all of a sudden they pop into your eye, if you know what I mean. It takes practice. So what are you worried about with the coating of the lenses? If he's buying a $75 set of binoculars, and he's getting an inexpensive set of coatings on the lenses, what is the major disadvantage that that might cause, John? KC2, WGD, K2RIW in the tech net.
Dick, in my experience, I've found that the poorly coated optics are also responsible for very poor chromatic aberration results. And when you're looking at pinpoint light, the chromatic aberrations are very annoying when you're trying to observe a star and determine what it is in a pattern because you're looking at a narrow field. That is, I don't know if you've ever seen that, but that is the issue with the poorly coated or the little less expensive. Better off buy a used pair that are properly coated because the chromatic aberrations are much less. That's what I found in my experience. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, there's a book by Suter, S-U-I-T-E-R, I think it is, something along the lines of measuring the optical quality of telescopes and binoculars and so on.
every not properly constructed and not properly aligned telescope, binoculars, and even microscopes, but telescopes for sure, can have a couple of kinds of distortion that are very annoying. Chromatic aberration, where the red, green, and blue, so to speak, don't all focus at the same point. And you look at a star and you see a halo of another color around the star. That's what John is referring to. Another kind of distortion is called coma distortion, where every star looks a little bit smeared off in one side, so it looks like it's got a tail like a comet. And in the case of a Newtonian telescope, that's the one that's got the mirror in the bottom and the 45-degree small mirror up near the eyepiece, to properly collimate that, that really means properly align the main mirror versus the small mirror, can make a big difference on how round the stars look and whether or not you're going to get distortion. In the case of a Cassegrain telescope, that's the one that's got the folded optics inside. Again, that proper collimation alignment is important. It's not a showstopper. It's something you can worry about later on and realign later on. And if you buy one that's got poor collimation, and Dave and I would buy it immediately because we would take on the responsibility or the challenge of realigning the telescope. But at first, if your inexpensive telescope has been misused and it's got improper alignment, and each star you look at has got a little bit of a comet-like tail off to one side, that's something that can be eliminated. But it's just something to know about, and it's something you don't have to live with. There's a lot to learn about astronomy, as you can tell. And once you start getting into astrophotography, you take a modern...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You take a modern-day photocoupled oscillator, I mean a photocoupled diode, you know what I mean, electronic-type camera, and connect it to a telescope. My goodness, can you get pictures like that Kodak film would never be able to give you in the past? They've gone a long way with that. Guys who are really crafty will take something called a 2U2 cam. This is a $100 camera that you put on your computer so that you and your buddies can send pictures back and forth to each other. And you properly modify that and maybe cryogenically cool it and add it to the eyepiece of your telescope. And all of a sudden your sensitivity of whatever you're looking at goes up by 100 to 1. Boy, you can see things you never knew were there. So there's a whole technology. You can climb that ladder with astronomy, and it's an awful lot of fun if you've got the slightest interest in science. And NASA is doing some extremely interesting things in astronomy, which I'm going to be mentioning in a little bit. K2KEY, K2LIW in the second half.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Let me just clarify, because they're going to ask some questions, and this way we can eliminate them. Thinking of what these answers will be. Basically, you mentioned two types of telescope. You mentioned a Newtonian-type telescope, reflective-type telescope, and I believe the other one is a Cassegrainian. Maybe I'm pronouncing it wrong, because I don't know much about, really, into telescopes that much. Is there, and you know, also we also mentioned this Keystar. Are they one of these two, or Dick over?
Okay. A refractor telescope is the old-fashioned kind. That's when you look at an old-fashioned movie and you see a ship's captain standing on the bridge and he's looking with his great big long telescope at another ship. He's got a lens in the front, a couple of intermediate lenses, and a lens in the back. That's a refractor-type telescope. And they're slightly popular up to about 3 inches in diameter, and they essentially do not exist beyond that diameter, and they start to get expensive real fast when you get beyond an inch and a half. And they're usually mentioned in millimeters, but I live in the imperial world. Beyond that, the next level of telescope is a Newtonian. That's the one that's got the big mirror at the bottom, a 45-degree mirror near the front, and off to one side is the eyepiece near the top of the telescope. That's a Newtonian. The next step in a folded optics-type telescope is you got the mirror in the bottom, a parabolic mirror, quasi-parabolic mirror in the bottom, another hyperbolic mirror near the front, and then in that particular Cassegrain telescope, there's a hole in the center of the main mirror, and the eyepiece comes out of the back of the bottom, or out of the center of the main mirror, and the back there is where the eyepiece comes out. That's a Cassegrain. And there's a variation on that Cassegrain, which is called Maksutov, a Russian design, where the correcting lens up front, by the way, the piece of glass up front that holds the hyperbolic small mirror, the second mirror, so to speak, that can either be a flat piece of glass, or in the case of a Schmidt Cassegrain, it can be a piece of glass that's got a slight corrective action to it, or in the case of Maxitov, it's a very thick piece of glass. So the folded telescopes come in Maxitov, Cassegrain, and the, those are the two main...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
As you go to these more and more folded designs, the price goes up pretty fast, the availability goes down on flea markets and whatever. You get the most of your money out of a Newtonian. That's the one with the simple mirror at the bottom and the 45-degree small mirror near the eyepiece near the top. You get the most bang for the dollar out of that, but it's kind of big. Each of these folded type, Cassegrain or Maxitov, are one-third the length is the good news, but they are a lot more expensive, and you got to treat them with a little bit more care. And very few people build a Cassegrain. Lots and lots of people build a Newtonian. So when it comes to home brewing, a Cassegrain home brew, I wouldn't take that on as the first or the second assignment, if you know what I mean. That sort of separates the men from the boys. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Comments again, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, I owned almost all of the that type of telescope. Celestrons, I had almost all of their models. There is another company that you can buy used, Mead. It's a very inexpensive telescope for what you get, and it is pretty good. And they are on the market used on eBay. The young guys might want to look into something like that. It's already assembled. They can have a ball with that.
Yeah, Mead is an extremely good company, and Mead wanted to buy the other company that makes Cassegrain. I can't think of the name of that other company. Celestron? Yeah, Celestron. So Celestron and Mead both make some very nice folded telescopes. Mead's in California, and where's Celestron? I think Celestron's also in California, aren't they, John?
I believe you're right, Dick. I think they are in California, yes.
So some of the quality brands in folded telescope are Mead and Celestron. And occasionally they do appear on the surplus market at very nice prices. Occasionally they appear on eBay. On eBay they tend to go for pretty high prices though. But once again, as I said, these guys are going to have to ask themselves the question, what do they really want to do with astronomy? And by going to, there are good astronomy clubs in every single state. With the right kind of a web search and word of mouth or whatever, you'll get an awful lot of information by just appearing at their meetings and just sitting and listening and asking questions. Because for the most part, you go to an astronomy club, you're being exposed to people with more than 10 years experience on general, to maybe 30 guys in the room. You're listening to hundreds of years of experience, and you just listen to what they say to each other. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, it was just a final question from me. You mentioned Cassegrain, Newtonian, and so on and so forth. The big telescopes, such as the one in Mount, was the Palomar telescope, or the one in Hawaii, the heck was the name of that? What was the name of that thing up on the hill there? Anyhow, what kind of telescopes are they? Are they one of these Newtonians or Cassegrain, or exactly what category is that, Dick? Over.
Yeah, all of those really big telescopes, most of them are a folded design. Most of them are a subset of what's called Schmidt-Cassegrain. There's something called a Ritchie-Krejcin, I think it is. There's a variation where instead of the mirrors being parabolic and hyperbolic, they're both hyperbolic. When it comes to a telescope that's specifically designed for astrophotography, where you want it to have a flat focal field, in other words, you want the image to come out on a flat piece of film, which is what the original design, they have to go to more elaborate techniques to do that. But it is, in general, a folded design. Most of them are Cassegrain-like. That's where you've got the light coming into a main mirror, It gets focused down to a smaller mirror up front. The smaller mirror up front is concave, correction, convex, it's hyperbolic, which then sends the light back down through the center hole of the main mirror, and then the eyepiece is behind.